I think I'm going to try to hold this. Maybe not. Okay. Can you hear me? Is that good? Okay. So thank you for inviting me to this extremely joyful event, and it's a privilege and an honor to speak with you. I have two simple goals for this talk. And the first is I want to share how I went from being a Jewish woman to a Jewish Christian woman or a Messianic Jew. And I hope that that will give you some empathy for Jewish people that you know in your lives and what they struggle with in terms of coming to faith. And secondly, I want to connect what I talk about to our chapter 13 in the book, The Seven Laws of Love, which is the chapter on loving yourself. And what has been kind of the theme for me of this talk is that working with God as he guides and transforms us is a way of loving ourselves. Okay. So, I'm going to start with my testimony. I'm going to tell you about my Jewish roots. These are my grandparents on my maternal side. Both my maternal and paternal grandparents were immigrants from Eastern Europe and Austria. And I was born into a very loving Jewish family. My maternal grandparents' story is very similar to Fiddler on the Roof. How many of you have seen that movie? Okay. So my grandfather was a tailor, and he was a tailor for the Tsar of Russia. He was making uniforms for the Tsar in Lithuania. But then a decree came down and said, no Jewish tailors can work anymore. So he saw the writing on the wall, thankfully, and he decided to leave his country as a young man, come to the United States, knowing nobody, having no experience, didn't know the language, but he saw the writing on the wall, and I'm so grateful that he did that. He had married my grandmother as a teenager. She had lost her father at age two, and she was a very good businesswoman. She started a grocery store, and he thought this would be a good partner for me. And but when he came, she said, I can't leave my mother. She was taking care of her elderly mother. And so she waited 7 years before she came. And then finally she was able to join him. They moved to Pennsylvania, and he was getting whatever work he could. So the first place that he opened was called a dish and tire store. And I was thinking, what is the connection here? It's like round things. So it's like, I don't know why they did that, but he just did whatever he could to survive. And then they finally opened a tailor shop in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And so they had moved out of their comfort zone. He moved out of his comfort zone from being in his home with his own language and became a stranger in a strange land. Okay. Oh, oops. I'm going the wrong way. These were the siblings of my grandmother. And they stayed behind. They didn't have the means to leave, and most of them were killed in the Holocaust. So 2/3 of the Jewish population of Europe was killed in the Holocaust. In Lithuania, they were taken to a cemetery and gunned down, and in other places they were sent to camps. So we were safe in our home in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But at the same time, we had kind of a shadow of having lost our family members. And that always was kind of part of our life and part of our memory. So after my father served in World War II, and after the war, he was eligible for what they called GI housing. They would give affordable housing to people who had served in the Army or any part of the military. And as a result, most of the East Coast when I was growing up was what we call Balkanized. There was the Irish area, the Italian area, the African American area, the Jewish area. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. But in GI housing, we were diverse religiously. So I had Catholic friends and Muslim friends and Protestant friends. And that was a very good environment for me. I had a loving home. We celebrated the Jewish holidays. We celebrated Sabbath with candles and challah and festivities. We had Passover. We had Purim. We had Hanukkah. And it was a beautiful upbringing. My parents had helped found our local synagogue, and my mother was a Sunday school teacher. My father was part of the men's prayer ministry. And so it was a beautiful life. It was a wonderful life. And yet, I still had an urging for something more. So have any of you heard of force field analysis? It's kind of a decision-making tool that is used in business and also personally. And what it says is that whenever you have a hard decision to make, there are forces driving you to change, and there are forces restraining you from that change. And so we're in this force field, and we just don't know which way to go. So do we change or do we stay the same? What do we do with that? So whenever you make a decision, sometimes people will say, well, what are all the constraining forces and what are all the compelling forces or driving forces, and what has the preponderance of the weight? What is the strongest? It's very similar to debate. Do we keep the status quo or do we change? So I was kind of caught in this force field, and so first let's look at why it was challenging for me and for most Jewish people to change, and those are the restraining forces. So first is historic and personal anti-Semitism. So we've talked a little about some of the anti-Semitism. It's actually from the beginning of Judaism, there's been a lot of anti-Semitism. So there was the Crusades and the Inquisition, and then there were pogroms, especially throughout Europe, where gangs would come in and riot and rape and murder and just leave people devastated. So there was a lot of persecution, and people were often told, you have to convert or we'll kill you and take everything you own. And so people that converted were called traitors because they were trying to save their own lives and denying God. That was the viewpoint. Then there's personal anti-Semitism. And especially, I think, for me growing up on the East Coast, there was a lot of personal sense of anti-Semitism, or being othered, or being different, or being not accepted. There were country clubs that we weren't allowed to join if we were Jewish. And then I remember as a little girl having other kids come up to me and say, you're a dirty Jew, or you're a Christ killer. And it was just kind of a shock, like, what? And then I had an extra neighbor, I loved her, but I would play in the front yard, and she would come out on her way to work, on the way to her car, and she'd always just kind of look over and go, you Jews are going to hell. And it was like, I'm so glad I don't have to continue this conversation. So it was like, there was just this sense of being othered and being different. Jews are about 2% of the population in the United States, and the estimates are 55 to 70% of the religious hate crimes are against us, and it's actually increasing right now. I went to a Yom Kippur service with my daughter in upstate New York just a few months ago, and one of the speakers was a local college student who said she was experiencing anti-Semitism on campus. And kids on campus are often told, don't wear your Star of David or don't wear your yarmulke if you're a boy because you don't want to get harassed. So there's this, when you feel othered and when you feel you don't belong, you cling to your group. So that makes, that's a constraining force. Then there's the comfort of being in the religion that I was in. It's a beautiful faith. There are many holidays. There's a sense of community and even tribalism and love there. So it's kind of hard to leave that as well. And let's see my time. The teaching of Judaism, it's strange because most Jewish people respect Jesus as a good rabbi, but they consider that the religion was is just not for us. It's not our religion. And what we're told is the Messiah will bring peace, and so we don't have peace, so we don't have a Messiah. And Eli Wiesel, who is a Holocaust survivor, once said, we both believe in the Messiah. Christians believe he has come and has come again, and Jewish people are still waiting. So he quoted Martin Buber, the philosopher, and said, let's just wait together, and when he comes, we'll ask him, have you been here before? So that's kind of the feeling. And then the last constraining force is you don't want to hurt your loved ones. You don't want to hurt your Jewish family and your Jewish relatives and friends. And I think a way to think about this is to consider what is a faith that maybe your kids would tell you, oh, I'm joining this faith. And like, as for those of you who are Christians, if your kids say, I'm a Christian too, that's a joyful thing. But when your Jewish family and you tell your family, I'm a Christian, it's a hurtful thing. It's like, what's wrong with what we taught you? Or why are you leaving? Or are you trying to fit in? And all of these things, and we don't want to hurt them. And then a really strong constraining force is the fear of annihilation. So there are about 15 million Jews left in the world. There are 1.2 billion Muslims, 1.3 billion Catholics, et cetera. So we're really a small minority. And if we become Christian, then what happens is we don't exist anymore. You know, then, and that is why you'll hear Jewish people saying, I'm a Jew for Jesus, or I'm a Messianic Jew, or I'm a Jewish Christian or a Hebrew Christian, because we don't want to, we're not saying that we want to fit in. We're saying we're still Jewish, we have our roots, but we've accepted our Messiah. So we're not trying to get rid of our race. Okay. So, then with all that, it's like, well, that's a lot to overcome, but what are the compelling forces, the driving forces that bring people to want to change? So first of all, for me, it was the very first things that made me start questioning were music. And Psalm 22, we're told, God inhabits the praises of his people. And sometimes you can feel that in worship, that you feel like God is there, he's inhabiting that. When I was growing up, we were allowed to have Christian music in grade school through high school. we were allowed to sing hymns and carols. And that's generally not something, I know when my kids went through the local schools, it was all Rudolph and, you know, Susie Snowflake, you know. It's like, but when I grew up, it was beautiful Christian hymns, and I remember thinking, just in my little grade school mind, there's something to this, because you don't have something so beautiful that doesn't have some truth behind it. And in a way, beauty kind of testifies and witnesses to the truth. So music was always a part of that through high school. And then secondly, there's just a desire for a stronger, closer relationship with God. In Ecclesiastes, we're told that God has put eternity in our hearts. And so there's always a longing that we have for something beyond this life. We know this life is fleeting and temporary, and no matter what you can accomplish, it's going to be gone. But there is eternity in our hearts. There is something more, and I wanted that. And so, like many Jewish people, I kind of joined the New Age movement, and I looked for any kind of way to increase my sense of a spiritual life. So I studied Zen Buddhism, a thing called Theosophy that Waldorf schools are based on, and then I studied Hinduism. I became a yoga teacher in San Francisco at the Integral Yoga Institute. I got a guru, and I went through all these things. And what struck me, though, as I went through this, is that it felt like in all of these paths for me, it felt like peace is right around the corner. It's right around the corner. You just have to level up to the next thing. You have to get a little better at how you're practicing, and then eventually you'll reach peace, and you'll reach nirvana, and you'll reach all of that. But it struck me as kind of elitist almost, and it didn't fit for me, so I was still searching. And then finally, I had an encounter with students of mine. So I was teaching public speaking. I had a summer class. It was very relaxed. And we were told as teachers, and especially if you took any students to competitions, don't have them speak on any topics that are controversial, like gun control, capital punishment, definitely not religion. And that struck me. One of the big Jewish values, and I'm sure it's Christian values as well, is freedom of speech. And to me it was like, why should we restrict our students? Plus we're still, this was years ago, we're still struggling with some of these controversial issues, and these are the issues students need to actually vote on, make decisions on, deal with, so why would we not speak about those? And then I thought, I might have students that might want to go into ministry, so why shouldn't they get to practice and talk about their faith in my class? So this was an interesting class. We had like half atheists and half devoutly Christian students, and they got along really well, and they supported each other, and it was just a wonderful environment. And I had three students who were attending Valley Bible Church. It's in Hercules now. You may have heard of it, with Pastor Phil Howard. He's a wonderful pastor. But at the time, their church was in an elementary school. They were meeting in an elementary school in Rodeo. And so these students, I know they were praying for me, but they invited me to an event at their church, which was in an elementary school. I thought, okay, I can go to an elementary school and listen. And the two speakers they had were Arnold Fruchtenbaum and Stuart Dowerman. Arnold Fruchtenbaum was a Polish Jew. He has a big ministry in Texas now called Ariel Ministries. His grandfather had memorized the entire Hebrew Bible, and his grandfather was this very prestigious rabbi in Poland who decided whether a tomato was kosher. So he had the bona fides, you know. And he had written this big tome I wanted to show you. the footsteps of the Messiah. So this person who had come from this very prestigious background had found the Messiah. And then the other person was Stuart Dowerman, who's written a lot of wonderful messianic but Christian music. And when I was listening to the music, I could relate to it. And I thought, okay, I can take a step now, because some other people have done that. In fashion, they have a thing called trendsetters, like the first people that do some kind of fashion. And then there's the early adopters, and then the middle adopters, and then some of us like are later adopters. I thought, okay, I have some trendsetters here, and I can follow them. And that's really important for Jewish people to feel like I'm not the only one that is doing this. I'm not the only one that is looking and searching this way. So they invited me, and I showed interest, and they said, okay, we'd like you to go to a Bible study with our pastor. So I got to go to a Bible study at the pastor's home and start learning and start having some of my questions answered, but I still had a lot of questions. He was very patient. My brother-in-law and sister-in-law were strong Christians, and so they would talk to me, and they would listen to all. I had so many objections. I was very difficult, but they were very patient. And then one day, my brother-in-law just said, you know, at some point you can go back and forth and you can come up with all these reasons, but at some point you just have to take a leap of faith. And I thought, you're right. You know, logically, the preponderance of the evidence is that Jesus is the Messiah. We have all of these prophecies. We have the blood sacrifice. We have the Passover foreshadowing of our Messiah. This is all making sense. So I said, okay, I will take this leap of faith. I'll walk out of my comfort zone. And it kind of felt like in the book of Joshua, these priests have to walk into this raging water and trust that it's going to go down and that they can carry the ark through. And that's what it felt like. Okay, I'm going to take this leap of faith. So I met with the baptism committee and asked, can I be baptized? I want to like take this step. And they talked to me and questioned me, and then the pastor said, she's as weak as can be, let's baptize her. And I was still giving him a problem. I said, okay, but when you talk about me, please don't use the word converted, because I'm still Jewish. And then also, I don't like the word saved, so please don't use that. And so I'm approaching the water, and he smiled and looked at me and said, so tell us, when did you get saved? And I said, I became a believer. And went into it, so we kind of had fun with that. But I'd like to now connect what happened after that to our chapter, and these are all on your handout, but and in the chapter on the seven laws of love. So I felt like I had shifted from feeling like I was betraying my faith to feeling like I was fulfilling my faith. And I felt like things were falling into place. I felt like I was at peace with my father instead of waiting for him to appear around the corner. And all of these elements became true for me. It wasn't until after my baptism, I went through some really tremendously challenging and difficult times. It involved a lot of hurt and guilt and pain and shame. And what I realized then was I began then to feel on a visceral level God's presence with me and with other Christians. And one of the beautiful things of coming to faith is that you have these sisters and brothers in the faith. Like, you can meet a Christian anywhere and ask them to pray for you, and they will. And it's an amazing thing to have that family. And God would send people to help me and just have those God hugs where you know that you are walking with him. And I really experienced what Augustine said, that our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. And that's what happened for me. And all of these things rang true for me that are written in our book for this fall. You're loved. You need Jesus. You are part of God's master plan. You can be completely forgiven. You don't have to keep striving and waiting and finding some other technique. You're not alone. You're part of God's family, and you have a home in eternity in heaven. And I wanted to share a little psalm that my then 5-year-old daughter wrote that I think encompasses this and how we can love ourselves by allowing God to love and guide us. She wrote, "God loves you. He cares for us all. When you share and be kind, when you share your toys, when you do something wrong, he forgives us because we aren't that big." And so what I found is that day by day, God guides us. He calls us out of our comfort zone. And he shows us how he wants to guide us and what our next step is. And when you love yourself, it's not a selfish thing. There's a trickle-down effect when you love yourself. When you love yourself, it affects other people. Because my grandfather left everything he knew to survive and love himself. He became a stranger in a strange land. He did not only make life better for himself, but he made life better for all of us who followed him. There's a saying, a Jewish saying, that if you save a life, you save a whole world. And by his saving his life, he saved all of us. And this is just, my brother has a group like this too, but that young man who made the trip and changed his name from Herschel to Harry to fit into the United States, and his wife with him, making a life and taking that risk and stepping outside of their comfort zones, has brought about all these people that I love. So I just want to say thank you for listening, and may God bless you, and may God keep you, and may God guide you through your comfort zone and out of your comfort zone, from strength to strength and from blessing to blessing. Thank you.